Good evening.
Good evening.
And I deeply apologize that I cannot speak a word in German. I promise next time I travel to this part of the world, I'll do a little bit of rehearsal. This evening, I would like to engage with you in a conversation around the social technology of presencing. And I'm aware that for a number of you, this is not new territory, either by the definition of it or by practice. But in order to begin to have that conversation, I would like to invite you to a quick conversation on this. What for you do you think are the three major challenges we are facing as humanity? And I'm just inviting some thoughts and some responses.
Social injustice.
Social injustice, thank you. What else?
War.
War. Mm-hmm. Species, thank you.
Climate change.
Hunger.
Depression.
Water supply. And one. Peace and war. As was mentioned in the introduction, some of the colleagues I work with also researchers and thinkers around MIT in the United States. And for the last 15 or 20 years, they've been looking at the same question. And among the many correct answers you have given, they sum it up in the following three. That actually, some of the three major challenges we face are these. Number one, it is the ecological divide. The separation, the artificial separation between ourselves as humans and nature. It's as if we can become successful in spite of or without nature being capable of renewing itself. The second major challenge they notice is social divide. This is the artificial separation between self and others. Somehow, we fantasize about one side of humanity developing and becoming better off, while the other part of humanity, we don't care what happens to it. For the first challenge, the artificial divide between ourselves and nature, if we continued, as you know, our patterns of consumption at the rate we are doing, we need 1.5 planets to sustain our capacity to consume at the level we are doing. I think we have known a lot about how to produce many goods and services that fascinate us. As far as I know, before I came into this room, I didn't come across any news around whether we have discovered how to create the other half planet we need to sustain our consumption patterns. For the divide between ourselves and others, it just means that close to 2 billion people on planet Earth go to bed without knowing where their next meal is going to come from. And frighteningly, if you look at the map and see which parts of the world are going to be hit hardest first, they are the same places where these 2 billion people are found. The majority of these 2 billion people are found. So it's a double tragedy. On the one hand, people get hit by environmental and sustainability, and at the same time, they are the poorest of communities in the world. And somehow there is also a relationship with the major parts of the world where these wars and atrocities are happening. You can't have a better time bomb for the rest of us. The third aspect you see is referred to as the spiritual divide, without meaning to be religious in any way. This is the separation between self and self, illustrated in the following realities. Particularly in the Western world, some researchers argue that 4 out of 10 human beings in their life have contemplated suicide because they are finding life meaningless. And some of the categories of people where these numbers are very high are the people we traditionally think as our carers, people in the medical profession. If those numbers are anything to go by, surely this must be cause for worry and interest for us to inquire into. And therefore, if we want to create a different future, it is not so much the case of doing that, shooting for the stars. You remember the movie Apollo 11? The astronauts went for the stars. The real deal in this conversation is the capacity to bend the beam of observation on ourselves. That is important, but there is the other side. You and I need to focus on the self. And when we talk about environmental and sustainability, them and us, self and self, the problem is not about that technology and that tool and that other thing. It's the capacity to bend the beam on ourselves. I will show you, and some of you, this is a repetition, but I invite you to see it anew. So when Apollo 8 went to the moon, their intention, as you know, was to discover the galaxy. And it was almost accidental. In a very casual way, as they were up there, one of the astronauts whose duties in the early part of the mission had come to an end, casually turned the camera on this little thing we live on called Earth. That was the very first vantage moment we saw planet Earth from another perspective. Let's see their experience again.
In 1968, Apollo 8 went to the moon. They did circle the moon, and I was watching it on television, and at a certain point, one of the astronauts casually said, "We're going to turn the camera around and show you the Earth." And he did, and that was the first time I had ever seen the planet hanging in space like that, and it was profound.
I think that for me, like for many other people, it was quite a shock. I don't think any of us had any expectations about how it would give us such a different perspective. I think the focus had been, we're going to the stars, we're going to the other planets, and suddenly we look back at ourselves and it seems to imply a new kind of self-awareness.
One of the astronauts said, when we originally went to the moon, our total focus was on the moon. We weren't thinking about looking back at the Earth. But now that we've done it, that may well have been the most important reason we went.
Describe what I've seen, you know, looking down at the Earth, and you see that line that separates day into night slowly moving across the planet. Thunderstorms on the horizon casting these long shadows as the sun sets. And then watching the Earth come alive, and you see the lights from the cities and the towns.
The events you see from space, like flying over thunderstorms, looking at them from the top, were spectacular. Like a fireworks show going on, and you're looking at it from the very top.
You know, shooting stars going below us or you know, dancing curtains of auroras. It's just very hard to describe all the, you know, the colors, the beauty, the motion.
My job as lunar module pilot was to be responsible for the lunar module itself and responsible for the science on the moon. So when we started home, I had a little more time to look out the window than the other guys because most of my responsibilities were completed. We were in a particular mode called the barbecue mode. So we were flying like this and rotating like that. What that caused to happen was every 2 minutes, a picture of the Earth, the Moon, the Sun, and a 360-degree panorama of the heavens appeared in the spacecraft window. And I had studied astronomy, and I had studied cosmology, and fully understood that the molecules in my body, and the molecules in my partner's bodies, and in the spacecraft, had been prototyped in some ancient generation stars. In other words, it was pretty obvious from those descriptions, we're stardust. Well, that was pretty awesome and powerful, particularly since I had a little more time at this point to be reflective and to think about it.
I invite you to turn to your neighbor and just quickly talk about what struck you. Okay, thank you. Just want to hear a few voices on what touched you. Yes, please.
The faces of the people, of the technicians, looking at those small little television sets.
Huh? Yeah.
They were astonished to see.
Yeah.
Wow.
Thank you. Any other?
The enormous beauty of this planet.
Yeah. Yeah.
It touches me directly to my heart. Very, very deep.
Thank you. Take two more. Any other comments? Yes, please.
This insight, we are stardust.
Yeah. Thank you.
I experienced love to the earth.
Yes. Yes, please.
I'm having a crazy idea of looking for something similar.
The craziness of looking for something similar. Any other thoughts? Yes, please. Yeah. We just aimed to go for the stars. And as it were, by accident, then they do that. And then they acknowledged maybe, and just maybe, that was the very reason we went for the stars. To go and be in that vantage position to be able to look at ourselves. My next question is, how do you, as an individual or as an organization, acquire learning? How do you acquire learning? Yes, please. Experience. Any other ways?
Looking at others, copying.
Observing others.
Doing something.
Taking action, doing something.
Mistakes.
Making mistakes.
Same.
Yep. In terms of learning, possibly we can categorize most of the learnings we do in two major ways. We do, as persons, as humans, as organizations, learn by reflecting on the experiences of the past. So what happens is that we act, we stop to observe our actions, we offer some reflections so that we can plan and begin to act again. This is also sometimes referred to as the Cobb method of learning. And to be fair, this has served us very well most of the time. My question is, what do you do in terms of learning when you do not have equivalents in the past to learn from? If, for example, you are trying to resolve how 7 billion human beings can live on planet Earth, no matter how hard you look in the past, you won't find a good example when we have lived as humans in a very fair way, sustainable way, as over 7 billion. If you are coming from my continent in Africa, one can say, no matter how hard you look in the past, it will be very difficult to find a good enough equivalent to see how we humans on that continent responded to a pandemic as big, as profound as HIV and AIDS. And some people would argue the current economic collapse that we are still recovering or trying to recover from has no precedence, not even the 1930s, compared to what we are facing as humanity if we continue our ways of doing things. And that is what gave some of the colleagues I work with the insight to begin to inquire, how else do humans learn? And this is what brought us here to share this conversation. Learning from the future as it emerges. And the term that has been coined to represent that is presencing. Simply put, when we put ourselves in the present moment, while at the same time reaching out for what is on the horizon, we have the capacity to conceive of what is emerging in the future. And having bent the beam of observation onto ourselves, then we know that we are the agents through which that future is going to be born. That's the whole story around presencing work. How do we access the emerging future? It is by confronting the brutal facts of our circumstances now, but not getting rooted into it. By the same act of understanding where we are, knowing, appreciating where we are, while we are still reaching out, what is emerging on the horizon, this is what we are referring to as presencing. And we'll talk about how different people do this. You do that, except that in most of our schools, this is not part of the deal. We train our children and ourselves into constantly looking back in order to learn. That is only part of the story. The other part of the story is that we humans, and I dare say, are capable of knowing the unknowable and seeing the unforeseen. But over time, we have diluted our capacity to simply checking the present and the past. I repeat, we humans are created from whatever source you want to cause creation with the innate capacity to know the unknowable and to foresee the unforeseen. So how does the process of doing that work? Again, spending a little bit of time and talking to different profound change makers, individuals who in one way or the other are demonstrating they accessed a deeper level of knowing before they took action. What journey do we see them walking? It's the following. The era for Lone Rangers is gone. When we could rely on one hero who would appear from nowhere and do the magic and solve all our problems. The era for Lone Rangers is gone. Our time, we will only manage to survive and overcome some of our challenges if we learn the art of co-creation. The capacity to connect with other people, not because we agree on the questions, on the answers, but because we agree on the questions that matter. What often divides us is that we jump to the solutions and we see how different we are in terms of solutions. The big deal is to focus on the common questions we hold together. They are the questions of hunger. They are the questions of environmental degradation. They are the questions of war. They are the questions of all these other things you correctly identified. And if we are talking about innovation, what do we see innovators do? They don't do inbreeding. So you don't pick medical doctors and sit with medical doctors in order to begin to find solutions. A few years ago, the British Prime Minister and the then Indian Prime Minister invited me and some of my colleagues to help begin to address the question of how do we reduce the cost of heart surgery from the current ranges of $20,000 to $1,000. And when they invited me to help define the way for doing that, and they wanted to bring 25 very gifted people from India and 25 immensely gifted people from the United Kingdom. My condition was, can only one person among those 50 be a medical doctor? And everybody laughed and said, Martin, come on. We are talking about a medical challenge here, and you want only one of them to be a medical doctor? I said, yes. And the rest, I said, look for a police officer, and look for a social worker, an engineer. Look for anybody else who does something else. Why? Because when we have diversity in the way we see the world, in the way we think, that is the primary raw material from which to craft a solution to a typical challenge. Our tendency is to want to pick people who are like us and begin to walk the journey. It only produces inbreeding. And when you practice inbreeding in the natural world, what do you have? Weaker and weaker species. So, stop. Listen to what life is calling you to attend to. Together with a diverse group of other people. And when you have agreed on the questions that really matter, don't do that thing which you learned in the business school. Don't start brainstorming. When you have agreed on what matters, you move on to the next thing. Get out of the four walls of your office or home. Go and sense the field. Like a good farmer does, you walk the field. The farmer, he or she, walks the field in the morning and in the evening, picks the soil, smells it, sometimes even tests it. You feel the texture of your plant, and then the farmer says, I'm going to move those strawberries from there and put them there. And that soil now that I know is good for oranges and not for bananas. They walk the field. So when you have agreed as a diverse group of people, go out, become experts by learning from the real experts. And the real experts is not by the number of degrees or qualifications they have. These are men and women, young and old, who are on the front end of the issue you are talking about. So in the case I gave you of discovering the cost of heart surgery and reducing it, we went and sent these 50 people to talk to medical doctors. They talked to surgeons. They talked to nurses. They talked to recovering heart patients. They talked to relatives of heart patients. They went and talked to manufacturers of the equipment that is used in the operating room. They went and talked to people who create the rules around healthcare. That's where you get the cutting-edge knowledge. You shorten the period in which you learn by talking to the people at the front end of the issue. And by so doing at the same time, because you are stepping in the world of other people, you are accessing a second faculty of intelligence. So you don't just sit and brainstorm with your open mind. You get into the world of other people, you open up a new level of wisdom, intelligence called the open heart. As you step in the world of patients, as you step in the world of doctors and nurses, the engineers who create those equipment you use, you cannot help but go there with an open heart. When you have sensed the field, the next deal, again, is to postpone brainstorming. So what happens is that you sit with others to allow inner knowing to emerge. One of the weakest moments of our time is that we have begun to celebrate what works against us. One activity after another. You wake up in the morning, and even before your eyes fully open, you stretch for the phone and to check the messages that may have come. And when you wake up, you dash into the shower room, you get into the litany of showering, looking for clothes, getting to the bicycle or to the car, the train, and as soon as you find a seat on the train, you open the laptop and begin to do things. And as soon as you reach the office, the phone call comes, the meeting comes. And this goes on until you begin to prepare to get home at about 6 p.m. and you get on the journey back home, and you tell yourself just before you get to sleep, can you do the preparations for the following day? And then finally you drop dead on your bed around midnight. And this goes on. And what do we discover from typical change makers? They allow these gaps when there seems to be nothing. Of course, I'm telling people who live in a beautiful place like this, for most of you, hopefully you do take advantage and don't pass at the fact that you have this beautiful nature around you. Change makers always have moments which we, the busy ones, call idle. It is in those moments that new insights are born. So the third point is to retreat and you allow inner knowing to emerge. When you move the level of knowing, not just here and here, but it begins to sit here. In the beginning, when I used to experience that, I used to associate it with diarrhea. It is when I have something so important that my bowels move. And I'm pretty sure from the work that you may have done with Tanya, you understand that our level of intelligence is more spread in our human body than just this. You remember who said, you know what is wrong with our time? It is because we have made the king serve the servant. Who do you think said that? What is wrong with our time is that we have made the king serve the servant. Any guess? Who might have said that?
Margaret Thatcher.
Possibly. Thank you. Who else do you guess? It was the much celebrated thinker of all time. It was Albert Einstein. If Albert Einstein...
I apologize.
No. That was part of the deal. If Albert Einstein said, intuition is the king, and the brain is its faithful servant. At a personal level, the very first time I experienced this was when I was working for an oil company, and my family and I were living in Cape Town. And the company put me on a training program to help transform the business in Africa. And after 1 year of learning and practicing, I somehow felt disappointed with myself. I felt disappointed because instead of focusing and thinking about the company, I felt myself drawn to my country. My family and I come from Zambia, in between Zimbabwe and Congo in the north. I tried to ignore what I was experiencing, but the thought kept coming, thinking about my home country, which had just undergone elections. And one morning, I got to my office, lifted my phone, and I called a friend back home and I said, could you find me the number to the president's office? And the friend asked, Martin, what have you been smoking? No normal human being wants that. But like all good friends are, after a few minutes, he calls back and he says, here is the number, but don't be silly. I somehow paid attention to his last comment, shoved the number away, and continued working like normal. 10 minutes before 5, I looked at the number. Some madness seeped in. I dialed the number. And the voice came, hello, this is State House. How may we help you? And I said, my name is Martin Kalungubanda. May I speak to the president? And then the voice went, is the president expecting your call, Mr. Kalungubanda? And I said, no, but it's important that I speak to the president. Music came, some silence. Then a new voice came. Hello, how may we help you? This is State House. And I repeated myself, my name is Martin Kalungubanda and I would like to speak to the president. The same question, is the president expecting your call? I sort of raised my voice a little bit and I said, no, but it's extremely important that I speak to the president. Silence. Music. And a new voice came. And by that time, I was getting a little bit impatient. So I went something like, I've been trying to speak to the president for the last few minutes. My name is Martin Kalungubanda. Then the voice on the other end of the line said, this is the president, Mr. Kalungubanda. How can I help you? And then at that point, I forgot why I had called. And when I recovered, I ended up saying the wrong thing. I said, I'm terribly sorry, sir, I didn't vote for you in the last election. The president laughed and said, at least you are honest about your vote. How can I help you? And then I said, I have been learning and reflecting about leadership, and I felt drawn to speaking to you. And then, to my surprise, he said, today is Wednesday. Are you able to come and see me on Friday, this Friday, 3 o'clock? I don't remember saying a normal bye. I had put the receiver down, and my hand was shaking. And then I looked at my director, who was sitting on the other end, and I sheepishly walked to him, and I said, I did something silly. I called my country, and the president has accepted that I can go and see him. I said, that doesn't work like that. To cut the long story short, I arrived at the presidential palace and the security didn't have my name. And I said, colleagues, I'm sure I wasn't dreaming. I really talked to the president. And one senior officer said, this rarely happens. But just in case this is the one time things didn't work, I'll walk with you to the inner office, and if we find that your name is not there, there is no other way we can help you. I said, that's all right. And we went there, and my name wasn't on the list. And when he was about to usher me, the president was coming from the next room in a meeting, and he looked at me and said, you must be Mr. Kalungubanda. And I said, yes, sir. And he said, come, we chat. And immediately we went and sat. And after an hour's meeting, then he said, I don't think I would understand all these things you are talking about in such a short meeting. What are you doing tomorrow? Do you think you could come home around 5 p.m., then we have dinner together, and then you can tell me more? I said, yes. And close to midnight on Saturday, I said to the president, Your Excellency, thank you for your time. I need to leave you to sleep. And then as I was about to leave, then he said, oh, by the way, this is really interesting. Do you think you can come and train me and all the ministers at some point? And believe it or not, I found myself saying, yes, sir. A year passed, my family and I had moved to Oxford where I was working, when someone at the reception called my extension and said, Martin, there is someone online claiming to be president. Do you want to take the call? And this was almost a year since I had spoken to the president. And then the president said, Martin, we are now ready. Are you able to come next week to come and give us some training? That's how I ended up being chief of staff to my head of state. And I have never had a better university than working for someone of power like that. And I've never had a much more privileged moment to serve my country other than when I worked with him. All I am trying to say is that when we allow ourselves to listen to much more than just the ear, we listen to this and that and here, there is a point at which we access what needs to be done. And if you subject that level of knowing to logic, you are missing the point. And I think each one of you, in one way or the other, have had moments like that in your life, when your level of knowing is not explained by this. And when we have this deeper level of knowing, what comes next is quickly jump into acting. If I had stopped to begin to think about, does it make sense to call the president? And what will my colleagues think if they discover that I tried to call the president? What about my boss coming to know my sense of judgment if he or she? So once you don't jump into action, you can only mobilize reasons why you are not going to go forward. Our capacity to scare ourselves when we get insights is immense. So what do we see from innovators and other people? They have a hunch. They feel it at the level of that and that and that. And when you have perceived it enough, you become a slave of your new level of knowing. You act in an instant. The rest of what needs to be known will be known as you do. You begin, then your hands lead you to the next, and the next, and the next. And as you prototype, there will be certain things you never foresaw that allowed you to become a little bit stubborn and go ahead and do something. When you shape up this and learn by doing, that's when you get the permission to evolve, to institutionalize, to play the game on a grand scale. Prototyping in this way helps you to avoid the mistakes we often do when we are piloting. Most of us, when we are piloting, what are we doing? We are simply wanting to prove the case and the justification for why we must scale up that. True prototyping is anchored on the following: fail often in order to succeed sooner. So failing is part of the deal. Fail often in order to succeed sooner. Those of you and our dear colleague who began with the piece of music will understand that artists before school takes them in a different direction. Do this with maximum ease. The capacity to get something and know what needs to be done in the moment and act, because it is not mere guesswork. You have summoned all your ability, all your faculties to perceive that which is about to be born, and it wants to use you as a vessel for arriving in the present moment. Why do you have so much faith in something you create? I always joke about this, because if I picked my phone and I said, hello, I am speaking, can I call you later? And then I said, oh, sorry, that was my brother in Iceland. You probably are going to believe me. What has happened is that you trust that this little thing I hold in my hand called phone has the capacity to pick my brother's voice wherever he is. It's because it has the receptors that allows it to pick things in an instant. This is the more primary instrument, which has the best receptors you can imagine. We are wired as a receptor. Once we learn to pay attention to what is going on in our system, we are the most primary and natural antenna for picking what is on the horizon and wanting to be born through us. It is not that thing which you created. It does the work, but it's because you are mimicking something that happens around ourselves. So when I said artists do this, those of you who have seen this, see it again, because it helps to see it on several occasions. So, this was in 1990 during the World Cup in Rome. Before Pavarotti died, you remember they were the three tenors. In this piece, like in all other situations of the World Cup. They had been tipped at least 2 years before that they would be performing, and performing live before 6 million people. So 6 million people, in business language, is high stakes, high risks, but also immense opportunity. So what do you do when you are faced with high risk? You choreograph everything to the letter so that you can try and reduce mistakes to zero. They had been practicing, and now here they are doing the thing. I would like you to pay attention to Zubin Mehta, who is the conductor, and you pay attention to Placido Domingo, the tenor. But I would also like you to pay attention to the larger field in which they are doing this game, and then we'll have a little conversation.
No puede ser, esa mujer es buena. No puede ser, una mujer malvada. En su mirar, como una luz singular, he visto que esa mujer es una desventurada. No puede ser. La vi llorar. Los ojos que lloran no saben mentir. Las malas mujeres no miran así. En sus ojos dos lágrimas vi y a mí me ilusiona que tiemblen por mí. Porque no sé vivir.
And again, I invite you just for 2 minutes to turn to your neighbor and talk about what caught your attention.
Thank you.
Okay. So, can we hear a few voices? What caught your attention? Yes, please.
In a way, they synchronized their body language.
Mm-hmm.
In another way, they were complementary.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you put it on slow motion, there is a point at which the movement of the two look like it's one body moving. Thank you.
But there was this amazing moment where he just dropped down everything.
Yes.
Drops down everything and just leaves him the place, and that's, I think, the most extraordinary moment.
Fantastic. And we will get back to that. Any other observations? Yes, please.
I think that the conductor had a moment out of space and time.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Another hand? Yes, please. They gave it all. Yeah, and
I think the conductor gave up to control everything. The music took over all of them.
Yeah. So there was a moment when the game was the way we played. You saw him just going like that. And then at another moment when you describe as the music took over. So when my colleagues went to interview them, they realized that at one time, Placido Domingo, the tenor, got consumed by music. And then he extended a few notches longer than they had been practicing. And Zubin, the conductor, at that point, who is a leader, feels two options. One, manage the risk. This is uncharted territory. 6 million people are watching. So he could have swung his baton, cut the whole thing short. You and I would never have noticed that it had been cut short. And then he said, I went for the second option, was to trust that Domingo wouldn't want to mess things up in this moment. And this is unusual. What does he do? It's what you described. He drops his hands. Conductors and leaders like you, we are paid for doing that. And it is unusual in that moment of what would seem as crisis, his instinct in that moment was to drop his hands. But he didn't drop his hands with negligence. He completely swung himself with, as it were, head, heart, and gut open to the tenor. And Zubin says, even if, for you who are watching, that looks like a few seconds, for me it looked like eternity. And at one point, Domingo's voice calls him back. That magical ending you get was never practiced. It emerged on the floor. You cannot lead profound change with rehearsal. You have to learn the capacity, the artistry of building the bridge as you walk on it. And it requires tapping into a different form of intelligence. It is when you can tap into the open mind, open heart, and open will, knowing very well that the entire body system is there to support you to access the unknowable and to access the unforeseen. We have underplayed for years and many times, and this has happened only in the last 100 years, of this thing we carry called me to access deeper levels of knowing. But it also requires that we surrender sometimes to our usual ways of seeing reality and yet expose the entire self to the new that is seeking to emerge. And as we saw in Zubin Mehta, it doesn't come without effort and challenge. And I would like you to see that little bit, just how it plays again.
Cuando en sus ojos dos lágrimas vi, ya vi la ilusión que tiemblen por mí. Porque no sé vivir.
And at this point, it wasn't normal break time. Placido Domingo invited Zubin off the stage. And when he was asked, why did you do that? He said, I knew I had put my colleague on a roller coaster. I needed him to recover. When we are doing profound work, the primary basic rule is just take care of each other. Thank you.